Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The country voted for change. President-elect Barack Obama will have plenty of opportunities to shake things up when he takes office on January 20th. But which Obama will it be? The Obama who championed a new post-partisan politics, or Obama the liberal progressive? And could it be both or not? In this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine, George Packer takes up the question in a big story headlined The New Liberalism. This hour on Point, George Packer on the path and politics ahead for Barack Obama. We will also hear this hour from different stripes of Democrats on their expectations of Obama. And you can join the conversation. What's the change you voted for? A new deal? More reaching across the aisle? Is it time for Democrats to push a full-on liberal agenda or something else, something new? Joining me now from New York is George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker. His article this week is titled The New Liberalism. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. George Packer, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
You describe a couple of Barack Obamas. Is it clear to you which was elected to lead here, the post-partisan Obama or the progressive Obama?
I think that during the course of the campaign, we saw both of them in sequence. The first year, really leading up to the kind of climax of the primaries, Obama really ran on being a new kind of politician and talked about a new politics that got beyond red and blue America and the old divides and the old polarization. And that inspired a generation of young voters to flock to his campaign and to create really a movement. I talked to some students at Dartmouth right before the New Hampshire primary, and they said to me, he's one of us. He's going to get us past the Clinton and Bush dynasties to something new in Washington. So they weren't looking for him to restore the Democrats to the White House after 8 years of George W. Bush. They were looking for him to cleanse America of the corrupting and sort of demeaning politics that we've been living with for decades now. But as the campaign went on, I think Obama saw that he had that movement. He had those voters. He did not have the more working class, less educated Democrats who are the backbone of the party and have been since the New Deal. And he lost a series of crucial primaries to Hillary Clinton and really very nearly lost the nomination to her because of those voters in places like Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania. And by the fall, Obama had found a new voice, which I think he partly learned from Hillary Clinton, or at least owed her something, which was a very full-throated defense of the middle class and an attack on, although he wouldn't use this phrase, what FDR used to call the economic royalists, especially after the crash of the Wall Street in mid-September. Obama started talking about the final verdict on a failed economic philosophy. So he was really saying not we're going to cleanse politics, or not only are we going to cleanse politics, we're going to turn the page on the Reagan era, which I think really lasted from 1980 until this year. And that was a more ideological Obama who was making some very specific promises about health care, about tax fairness, about jobs, about energy. These were fairly nuts and bolts economic issues that I think got him elected because they allowed him to win over the skeptical voters I mentioned earlier who between, say, April or May and October decided that Obama was a credible president. I think it was largely because economic forces pushed him to the left on economic issues, and that's where those voters were. I mean, this was a watershed year in which the old Republican rhetoric of tax cuts and spending cuts and anti-government, which McCain and Palin pushed more and more, especially after they discovered Joe the Plumber in Ohio, it didn't work. This was a very clear election ideologically. And the country, I think, said that those nostrums no longer apply. We need something new. And Obama got that message because he's a superb politician. And so, in a sense, both Obamas won. And the question is, how will he reconcile them once he's in office?
So a clear verdict, maybe, on ideology, but a candidate who ended up becoming president-elect who wasn't perfectly clear himself about where he stood between this postpartisan sort of new way and a progressive way. You spent a lot of time in putting this piece together, George, talking with Democratic Party thinkers about what they sort of read in the oracle bones of Obama here. How do they interpret what's coming?
Well, there's some differences, as you might have guessed. One person who's rather close to Obama, who's known him for years at the Chicago Law School, Cass Sunstein, a law professor who's now at Harvard, he calls Obama a visionary minimalist, by which he means someone with large goals, but who, in order to achieve those goals, wants to create as much consensus as possible, to violate the core values of as few people as possible. So he won't be drawing bright lines. He won't be saying, as Reagan, he won't be saying the opposite of what Reagan said, government isn't the solution, it's the problem. We won't hear from Obama, government is now the solution. He won't say, as Roosevelt said, those economic royalists are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred. You just can't imagine that coming out of Obama's mouth. On the other hand, people like Robert Kuttner of the American Prospect, more traditional liberals, think that the great mistake Obama could make is to go too slow and to be too timid and to allow the economy to spiral downward ahead of him instead of getting out in front of it and have his presidency end up perhaps like Jimmy Carter, swamped by bad economic conditions. And Kuttner thinks that Obama needs to be willing to spend upwards of $600 or $700 billion early next year on a stimulus package that would include a range of things. Paul Krugman feels the same way. Krugman has been critical of Obama for being too soft and too willing to reach across the aisle when, in fact, what may be coming his way from the other end is the paw of a tiger in the form of the Republican Party. So these are the sort of the competing versions of what different Democrats want. I don't think they're actually mutually exclusive. I think what we will see is Obama reaching out. He's not going to put a horse's head in the bed of Joe Lieberman.
He's already indicated that. He said, let's keep Joe in the fold.
He may well keep Robert Gates on as Secretary of Defense. He will be that conciliatory, encompassing politician who doesn't use rhetoric to divide. I think that is what postpartisan means. It doesn't mean splitting the difference on every issue. It doesn't mean finding the exact center of Democratic Party or American politics. And I think on especially the economic issues that were the heart of his campaign down the stretch, he's going to be bold. He's going to reach. And as his new chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, said the other day, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. This crisis gives the Democrats the opportunity to restore some of the old social compact that was put together during the New Deal and that has been frayed and damaged over the last few decades.
Do you think there's that kind of moment in front of us here, a crisis so severe that Americans, that Republicans will put ideological fears behind them and just roll with Obama here? Can he really avoid, if he starts getting into major programs and policy changes, can he really avoid the battle royal either within his party or with the GOP?
I don't think it's going to come within his party, not at the beginning. I think his presidency is going to represent such sweeping change. And he really does have a mandate. I mean, he won by just as much as Ronald Reagan in 1980, and Reagan was not shy about claiming a mandate. He has a mandate on the things he ran on and on those things, which are health care, energy independence, tax fairness. I think he would be wrong to pull back because he will never have more support than he does at the beginning of his presidency. And I think that will come almost unanimously from his own party. As for Republicans, well, what's left of them in Congress is going to be more conservative than what came before. I mean, they have essentially killed off their own moderate wing, and it's concentrated in the South. And it may well be a kind of a knot of resistance to what Obama might try to do. But David Axelrod, his brilliant strategist, said to me when I was reporting this piece, do the Republicans really want to get in the way of solving some of these chronic problems? And I think that's the way Obama will present it to the country. Not now it's our turn to lead, but rather now we have to come together as a country to solve these problems that have gone neglected for such a long time.
Do you see an FDR scale ambition in President-elect Obama?
No, this is not 1933. FDR took power at a moment when the country was pretty as close to revolution as it's ever been, and a quarter of the workforce was unemployed. There were desperate tent cities going up all over the country. It was a crisis like nothing we've seen except the Civil War, and Roosevelt could have assumed almost dictatorial powers. He didn't, but he did radically rewrite the rules for the role of the federal government. I mean, he had, at the beginning of his presidency, the National Recovery Act, which put the government front and center in the business of economic planning and setting codes for business. Eventually, it was struck down by the Supreme Court. We're not in such a deep crisis. But, I mean, look at the front page of the newspaper today. GM is saying it may go out of business if the government doesn't intervene. The Democrats are saying we have to intervene. The lame duck president seems to be saying only on certain conditions. These are I mean, we've already semi-nationalized banks, and this was a conservative president who
under George
did it,
W. So. Bush. George Packer, please stand by. We have to take a short break. George, we'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the New Yorker magazine's George Packer about whether Barack Obama will be post-partisan or liberal progressive or maybe something new in the White House. His big article in this week's New Yorker is The New Liberalism. In just a couple of minutes, we'll hear from a couple of Democrats of different stripes on their expectations from Barack Obama. George Packer joins us from New York. And, George, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join you from Jacksonville, Florida. Joseph, you're on the air with George Packer.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Well, what do you think, Joseph?
Well, I'm just not so sure. I mean, yes, Barack Obama talks a good talk, but it's just like every other person who has been president, they say what you want to hear until they actually get there. But if you really listen to what I've heard this man say, it just seems like it's leading us down a road to socialism, almost, you know, like Germany is communism and in a lot of other states, you know, where the government does everything, the government owns everything, is socialism, and then you're not free anymore. That's what's so beautiful about America, that business runs the business and people run their homes, and you know, is that where we're going, to socialism with Barack Obama?
Joseph, let us pick it up with George Packer. George, you've talked to a lot of folks. You know that was the Republican tag on Obama at the end of the campaign in particular. It stuck in Jacksonville. It stuck with Joseph. Speak to his concern, George.
Well, look, first, it's a Republican president who partially nationalized the banks. I mean, that's how desperate Wall Street was in September. And now we're looking at Detroit and perhaps other industries coming next and saying, you've got to bail us out too and maybe buy some shares, maybe even take over the management. Well, this is not coming from Democratic politicians. It's coming from business. It's coming from finance. So those are the economic conditions, the realities. Forget about the ideology. Barack Obama is not going to lead us to socialism or communism or really any other ism. He's not a particularly ideological man, I don't think. If you read his books, he's really basically pragmatic and is cautious, maybe even cautious to a fault. What I think he will do is restore something of the balance. Ever since the 30s, we've had a mixed economy where government had a role in providing a safety net beneath which Americans would not be allowed to fall. And in being the spender of last resort during economic downturns, which is basic Keynesian economics. Over the last couple of decades, that safety net has been shredded. And now we've got people without health care who are working two or three jobs. We've got people whose pensions have disappeared market downturns. We've got tremendous economic insecurity. And if Barack Obama didn't win because he spoke to that, then what was it that elected him? I think Americans are... The caller's absolutely right, are deeply anti-government by nature. We don't want the government running our lives. But there are times, and this is one of them, when the market has failed. Alan Greenspan, none other than Alan Greenspan, admitted it. So what does government do? It has to step in and restore some of the balance between public and private good. And I think that's what a President Obama will do.
George Packer, please stand by. I want to hear from a couple of Democratic Party voices right here. Joining us first from Chicago is Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. She represents the 9th District in Illinois. It's on the Northwest Chicago side. She's a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman Schakowsky, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
And with us from Washington, Will Marshall, co-founder of the Democratic Leadership Council, which aimed, was very prominent in the 1990s, to steer the Democratic Party toward a more centrist orientation. He's president of the Progressive Policy Institute. Will Marshall, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Jan Schakowsky, first to you. Do you expect a new deal from Obama? Are you expecting a big progressive push or the post-partisan hold hands across the aisle Obama, and can he do both?
Well, I really think he can do both. You know, I've known Barack for 12 years. He's a good friend of mine. I served with him in the Illinois legislature. And I really saw his gift of bringing people together and the pragmatism that Mr. Packer talked about in his article, that he is less ideological and less partisan and more just about getting the job done. And that's what the American people are wanting right now. There is a change, however, though, in the American electorate, and that is that they definitely are more amenable to the idea that government can help them in their lives and are looking for solutions. And I actually think that the challenge of this new administration is to deliver on some things that people see early on that improve their lives. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure to have some deliverables where people say, yeah, he came in and he's already making things better.
But you know, Congresswoman, that there's all kinds of conventional wisdom out there saying, President-elect Obama, don't overreach. Don't go too far too fast or you're going to get into trouble. You can find pundits up and down the block saying don't overreach. Are you afraid of overreach or underreach from
Obama? You
know,
I don't see the possibility even of that, because we have a very diverse Democratic caucus. Of course, the Republicans will be there as well with a somewhat different tune. But I actually think that everybody who wants to get reelected is going to be on a page that we had better respond to the demand that people are expressing right now, that we do something to create jobs, to settle the economy down, to address health care. And I think that the end of Mr. Packer's article is so important, that if there's a movement at his back, if the movement that elected him is still there, then we have a great possibility of moving this agenda. But not too far. I don't think there's any chance of that.
Will Marshall, in Washington, you know there's a lot of hunger pent up in the Democratic Party among Congresswomen, people like Jan Schakowsky, for a lot of action to deliver, as she says. Are you concerned that the party will overreach with progressive policy? You represented a kind of centrist championing in the 1990s. Or do you see the possibility of what George Packer describes, of President Obama, who's both post-partisan and progressive somehow?
Well, I think you've got to be both, and I'm not worried about overreaching now. I mean, the situation that Barack Obama will take over in January is a foundering boat, and he's going to be furiously bailing. It's not as though he's going to be able to launch huge new liberal projects. He's got to deal with the emergency at hand. And that will probably shove aside some of his priorities that I agree with and share on health care and investment in green jobs and energy and so forth. So I don't really see a danger of overreach. I only hope that all the groups in the party will sort of give him room, give him space to operate, not start pressing demands. And look, we have our own ideas about where we should be investing in this country, and we want a new social contract of the kind that George wrote about in this very fine piece. So even as centrist Democrats, have a pretty expensive agenda that's aimed at trying to restore the middle class in this country. But the immediate thing is to let this guy have the space he needs to stabilize the financial system and deal and make sure that the recession that he's undoubtedly going to find himself in doesn't turn into a depression.
George Packer, Will Marshall says he hopes the party doesn't start pressing demands on the new president. But you know from your research for this article, there are a lot of expectations and waiting demands standing in line out there, George.
Well, there's expectations across the country, not just from the party. I think his election has just created a surge of hope and expectation, which Obama will really have to draw on all his political skills to manage. But I think Will is absolutely right, and Congresswoman Schakowsky is right. I don't think there's a great divide in the Democratic Party today. I said earlier this isn't 1933. It's also not 1993. We're not going to have a president who's got a divided and quarreling Congress that's been in power for too long and has grown rather sclerotic. Instead, what we've got is an energized Congress that only took the majority 2 years ago, and it's going to want to see Barack Obama succeed, and he's already shown that he is able to reach out to Congress and values it. He's put a congressman right next to him in the Oval Office, Rahm Emanuel, in a way that perhaps Bill Clinton didn't do. So I think the party just isn't going to be fighting core battles the way it was in the 80s and 90s. I think you could say the Progressive Policy Institute helped the party resolve some of the difficult social issues that was causing it to lose votes to Republicans. And those issues are no longer front and center. We are dealing with economic issues. And on those issues, I think the party is pretty united.
Congresswoman Schakowsky, are you so confident of that? I mean, you're in the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Not every Democrat is, and you've got your straight-up blue dogs. Are you confident that you don't have a divided Democratic Party at this point? Aren't you going to have debates about how far to go, on what fronts, how fast?
Well, I think some of the debates will take place over, are we going to spend money to help the American people, or how important will deficit reduction be? Obviously, that there's going to be some debates, but I think the pressure to address head-on some of these problems is unavoidable. We're going to have to come up with solutions. It is no longer acceptable. There are too many serious challenges facing our country right now, and if we fool around and spend our time arguing, then I think each member of Congress is in peril. The Democrats have a tremendous obligation right now to make some things happen, because now we're totally in control. And so I think that will help to resolve some of the problems that we're facing. But it is a new time. I like what Mr. Packer wrote at the beginning of his article. He says, the idea that government should take bold action to create equal opportunity for all citizens doesn't have to explain itself in a defensive mumble. As someone who's been doing this for a long time, I feel like we've been in a defensive crouch about this for a long time. Now the majority of Americans are saying, let's go. We know that government can't do everything. Barack Obama said that in his 2004 convention speech, and he's said it ever since. Everyone knows that government can't do everything, but the government can do some things. And he said that despite the economic crisis, that we are going to have to do a few things, and that has to do with health care and energy and education.
It is a striking observation George Packer makes in The New Yorker. For the first time since the Johnson administration, he writes, the idea that government should take bold action to create equal opportunity for all citizens doesn't have to explain itself in a defensive mumble. Jan Schakowsky, Will Marshall, George Packer, please stand by. Lots of listeners want to join us. Steph in Las Vegas, Nevada. Steph, you're on the air.
Good day, everyone. Everybody talks about pragmatism, socialism, liberalism. I feel that the first 4 years are going to go to a balance of all of it. However, if we look at it very, very carefully. He's going to come out of the chute and balance what we need to look at from not only a perspective of healthcare, jobs, and the overall idea of Americanism that we have out here, but he's going to instill to us, this is what we need to do. And then it's going to end off probably in a conservative ideal, because if you look at the days of the Reagan era with the directions of the Clinton era, it kind of balanced itself out that way. If anyone wants to take a stab at my comment about that, please let me know, and I'm taking my arm off the air.
Okay, Steph, thanks for calling. George Packer, Steph says he thinks on balance it's going to be back to conservatism. Well, how about that? You do write that you don't see it going exactly back to old-style Democratic politics and policy, that the Reagan years will be part of the picture, even if it's an Obama administration.
Right. I mean, we have in our minds the famous image of the pendulum swinging every 30 years or so from left to right. And that actually, it does seem to happen 30 or 40 years, but it doesn't swing back. It swings forward to something new. And the Reagan era will be with us. It won't be reversed. Obama himself has said Reagan had some crucial insights and, above all, was a transformative president of the kind Obama wants to be. The importance of markets, of incentives, of efficiency, of getting government out of the way when it doesn't do something as well as the private sector. All those lessons should have been learned and have been learned. But right now, they're no good to us because events and conditions are pushing in the other direction where government needs to play a big role. So in a sense, what we've got is a convergence of, I think, the end of the conservative era, the rise of a new kind of politician in Barack Obama, and economic conditions which are creating the circumstances for this new politician to define a new era. And I call it a new liberalism, and I use that word deliberately because I think part of getting out of the defensive mumble is calling things by their name and not being cowed by liberalism's opponents. It had been a dirty word for a long time. I'm actually picking up that people are starting to use it again, and to me that's a good sign.
Will Marshall, you come out of the DLC. You co-founded it. Do you see liberalism making its way back as a flag the country will rally around? And let me ask you this, Will. If Obama should go too far by your lights, what would be a sign of that? What would be a bridge too far in what he might push for by your lights, Will?
Well, look, it's all in the definition. I like the shape and sound of George Packer's new liberalism. If it's a question of returning to the liberalism, what I would call interest group liberalism of the 70s, that would be a monumental era, but I don't think Barack Obama is going to do that. So, yes, some kind of new liberalism, new progressivism. I can live with any terminology, and I accept the point that thanks to monumentally bad governance from George Bush, Democrats are have recovered their ideological swagger, if you will. Our mojo is back philosophically, and I think that's a good thing. But look, let me offer two cautions, okay, I don't think that that Barack Obama is going to be driven off a cliff by the left or the party or anything like that. But here's the real situation. You know, he has got to persuade a country that's been living beyond its means for too long to spend less, to save more, to defer things as gratification. There's a reconciliation here. Our whole fiscal situation in the country is a story of having spent too much, consumed too much, and saved too little. It's not just a question of what happened in the markets or what's happening with GM. It's a question of every household that's done this. So he's going to have to get the American people to make some sacrifices. So this isn't going to be just a matter of big new spending programs are going to benefit everybody and the rain's going to fall across the electorate and people are going to be grateful for these new benefits. This is going to take some wrenching adjustments in the way we live. And I think we got to be clear about that. Secondly, and this is a really big problem for Barack Obama and the Democrats and an obstacle to this new liberalism that I think we all would like to see emerge, and that is residual public doubts about the efficacy of government. There's, when they say they trust government, you ask them whether they trust government, we're talking about 17% that express any sort of high confidence of what government can do. Again, I attribute that to what's happened in 8 years. When you have a wrecking crew in who ideologically are disposed to not use government to solve people's problems, well, you've got what we've got. So this president's going to have to proceed in such a way that he incrementally builds confidence that when government is active, it really is helping people and not just compounding their problems.
We're up against it, Hill. Will Marshall, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us. And Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Chicago's Northwest Side. Congresswoman, Thank you for being here. George Packer with The New Yorker, stand by. We'll be right back with much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with The New Yorker magazine's George Packer about whether Barack Obama will be post-partisan or liberal progressive or something new in the White House. His article, you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, is The New Liberalism in this week's issue of the magazine. George Packer joins us from New York, and right now Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I'm at work banging some nails, and my question for George and whoever else wants to weigh on it is, do we think that Obama can be the kind of president, and I hope he can, that can get past partisanship, but in a particular way, to talk about programs logically, clearly, present the pros and cons? A good example would be health insurance. Almost all of the civilized industrial world that I'm aware of has looked at this issue, and unanimously, they've decided, no, this should not be for profit because it's just too damn expensive. When you add profit into the picture, it just gets really expensive. And to just sketch that out for the country, here's what we can do. Here's one way to do it. We do it not for profit, run by the government. Examples would be Social Security. You go down the programs, you talk about the money, and the alternative is for profit. I think you could do that in a nonpartisan way. My question is Obama the guy who can do it? Because, boy, do I need to get some health insurance.
out of slogans and into practical details, Georgia, it sounds like Sam is kind of singing the song that you're conveying here of Barack Obama. That is his basic instinct to do that.
I think it's his basic instinct to speak like a grown-up to grown-ups. If you were to put post-partisanship in the fewest words, that's how I would describe it. There's a passage in his book, The Audacity of Hope, where he talks about every time we dumb it down or speak down to the public or use sound bites, we do worse. And I think that's at the heart of his idea of politics, is to treat it as a grown-up vocation. As for policy, he was kind of cautious on health care. You might remember that Hillary Clinton had a more liberal health care plan than Obama. She had an individual mandate. Everyone had to buy into some health plan. But his is not mandated, but it is close to universal, and it involves some government role. I mean, there's an option to buy into a kind of Medicare-type plan. I don't think he campaigned on single payer. I think if he tried to pass single payer, that's the sort of thing Will Marshall might have been warning us about, that he might be pushing too hard to disrupt what, Sam's absolutely right, is a dysfunctional system. But he needs to create the political conditions for the country to accept a change. So I don't think the country is looking for just any change at all, and I think that might be too much too soon. Now, the Republicans said that's where we're going to end up under Obama. Maybe we will. Maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. But I don't think that's where he'll start, because that's not what he campaigned on. I think he was very clear. I mean, the two-year campaign has a function, and it's to flush out what these candidates say they'll do, far more than in 32 when FDR was very vague about what the New Deal really meant. I think Obama has a pretty clear set of policy proposals, and health care is one of them.
I guess there's a question about whether that sort of cool, level-headed talking to the nation would be enough to get past ideological and practical objections to some of these. You know, I wish, George, I don't know if you've got this in front of you, though. I wish you would read some of the FDR that you were quoting in your piece from September 1932 in particular. It was fascinating to read how Franklin Roosevelt was thinking about the presidency. Do you have some of those there?
I don't have it. You'd better read it. But okay. I think you mean when he talked about moral leadership.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Here he is. People loved FDR and people hated FDR. But the way he thought and talked about the presidency was fascinating. This is September, before his election. And he said, he was asked by a reporter, and you're quoting him here, George, in The New Yorker. He was asked his view of the job that he was seeking. And FDR said, the presidency is not merely an administrative office. That's the least of it. It's more than an engineering job, efficient or inefficient. It is preeminently a place of moral leadership. He said, all our great presidents were leaders of thought at times when certain historic ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified. And then Roosevelt asked, He said, isn't that what the office is, a superb opportunity for reapplying, applying in new conditions the simple rules of human contact, human conduct we always go back to? It sounds so great, but as you point out, George, within months, he was in hammer and tongs battle with political foes and saying, if they hate me, bring it on. I'm going to fight.
You're right. That's the kind of language that you just quoted that I think Barack Obama would be very comfortable with. Mm. And it's in some ways, it's Lincolnian. And we all know that Lincoln is Obama's favorite president. He told us on election night, or actually at his first press conference after being elected, that he's been rereading Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Lincoln's first inaugural is a great summons to post-partisanship. We are not enemies, but friends. But you're so right that politics has a way of crashing through that kind of language and forcing hard choices and bitter oppositions on presidents. And that is absolutely going to happen to Barack Obama. It may well be that the remaining Republicans in Congress, who will be more conservative than previous Congresses, will act as a block in both senses of the word and try to prevent the Obama agenda from passing. That's what they did with Bill Clinton in 93. He got no Republican votes whatsoever on his key legislation. And that might happen again. If so, we'll see what kind of president Obama is. FDR turned out to be a marvelous manipulator of power. He loved using power. He loved drawing lines and cutting deals and finding allies and in some ways punishing opponents. Does Obama have the toughness, the ruthlessness, really, to govern, not necessarily in a partisan way, but in an effective way? Because part of effective governing means punishing opponents, making it difficult for people to oppose you, finding unlikely allies and keeping them in your fold, creating a coalition. Well, his movement, the people who are on his email list, are sort of the core of his coalition. But can he hold on to them and expand them so that he really has a mobilized public behind him? That's what Roosevelt did. The fireside chats created a popular support base for his program so that when congressmen opposed him, they did it at the peril of their own careers. Can Obama make it that hard for congressmen to oppose him by getting the public behind him? Will he use the internet in the way that FDR used radio and Reagan used television?
Of course, FDR, with all that, as you write, fundamentally changed the American idea of the relationship between citizen and state. Question is, perhaps, if Barack Obama may be changing it again, if he's got the kind of grit to do that.
I don't think he's going to change it as fundamentally as Roosevelt did. That was such a clear break in our history from 100-plus years of individualism to a modern notion of the state ensuring that there's some security for its citizens. I think that's been weakened. It hasn't been destroyed. Obama's job is to strengthen it again, but the basic change already took place in the 30s. I don't think anything quite as radical is going to happen now, but the problems are huge. And as Will Marshall said, they are in some ways conflicting. He does have to bring us into a new era of perhaps of scarcity, as David Brooks has written, and at the same time, jumpstart the economy by spending money. Austerity is not what's called for at this stage of a recession. And people like Paul Krugman are urging Obama to be willing to drive the deficit over $1 trillion in order to both restart economic activity and begin to solve some of these chronic problems that have been neglected in education, in health care, in wages, in economic inequality.
We've got so many callers who want in. Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and James. Hi, James. You're on the air with George Packer.
Hi, thanks.
Hi.
The main thing I'm looking for in Barack Obama is mostly foreign policy. I just really want him to close down the Guantanamo cage, where I just can't believe every time I see a picture of these guys, you know, in a cage all day like they're animals. I mean, they're, you know, bring them to America, give them habeas corpus. You know, we have a constitution. You know, if we have American soldiers down there representing us, then the people who they're, you know, holding ought to have, you know, the same rights as any American citizen. You know, and close down these supposed, you know, black ops prisons in other countries where we don't even know anything about that. These are the kinds of things I'm looking for in this president. I can't believe it's gotten to the point where torture is just, the guy can President Bush can torture, and nobody, people are afraid to speak up. And then when they do, nothing happens. Congressmen can't do anything.
Get the country's foreign policy back in line with its core principles. Do you see a President Obama acting swiftly on that front, George?
Well, I think there's already a report out that that's exactly what he intends to do with Guantanamo. It was just out a couple of days ago that what the caller from Charlottesville wants is what the administration intends, to close down Guantanamo and move those defendants into the American court system. And that, I think, would erase a terrible blot on our history, and it would also signal to the world that Obama is not just a new-looking president and a new-sounding president with a new kind of name, but is actually going to make a difference in how America stands in the world. But I would add a very big caveat. Foreign policy is the area that presidents have the least control over. Whatever they intend going into office, something else drives them in a new direction. It happened to Kennedy. It happened to Reagan in a different direction. It happened to Clinton, who wanted to focus on the economy, and instead Bosnia and other places kept flaring up. That's going to happen with Obama. And I think on foreign policy, he has a less clear idea of his direction than on economic policy. I think that's where the cautious and pragmatic Obama will really not be driven by a set of commitments that he's made. The big issue is going to be Iraq. He has said he will get our combat units out in 16 months. He's going to find early on that as they leave, parts of Iraq begin to slide backward. I'm almost certain of that. And then the question will be, what does he do? And I don't know the answer, but my guess is Obama will be more cautious on foreign policy, perhaps more centrist than some of his ardent supporters in the primaries wanted him to be.
Let's take a call from Ted in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for a great show. Just a couple quick points. One is I really would like to see from Barack Obama. I was a big supporter of his in the beginning, and then I still am, but I think I'm not as idealistic as at first. One is I just hope that we can in some way get religion out of Washington, D.C., and get science and facts and objectivity back into D.C. Two, it would be nice to see a Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, those kinds of people actually answer questions from reporters. And finally, just one more thing. I would just like to see, I think that he was pushed in the beginning by what some might call his base, which is, maybe the way left. And I hope he's not so apologetic about that support, because as you referred to in your first hour, he shouldn't be apologetic about religion, and he shouldn't be apologetic about who got him to where he is. And
Ted, on economics, there's a lot of talk about potentially Lawrence Summers coming back in, or Robert Rubin. They were very active with Bill Clinton in the 90s. Yeah, would you welcome them back then or not?
No, so I guess that was a point I made to your screener. My point is with the social compact that the author mentioned earlier, I don't think you start with a social compact, or he initiates it, by bringing back in people like Rubin and Summers, who are intimately linked to Greenspan, who, in my opinion, is one of the public enemy number ones. That's not the way to start, I think. I think you need to start new and, look for new people in the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. So thanks.
Ted, thanks very much for your call. Let me hold that and get a call here from Martin in Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you very much. Yes, I'm listening. I keep hearing that Barack is a pragmatist, and he's going to take care of us by pragmatism. No question, there's plenty wrong. No question, the creditor class has gotten much too controlled, just as in pre-recession America, when Herbert Hoover and the close the border people and the high tariff people were in. This has gone too far over these years. There's no question about that. But when we start talking about pragmatism and how to fix it, again, pragmatism is not morality, and pragmatism is not going to result injustice or prosperity. And if you can't look out for the little people in your society, and you can't have justice.
Who do you mean by the little people, Martin? Who do you mean?
Well, I mean the people that the debtor class, the farmers that get foreclosed.
But Barack Obama always talks about the middle class. Is that not looking out for the little people, or someone else you have in mind?
No. the middle class is not necessarily the little people. If you define the middle class up, which is what happens, then they get taxed too. Their ox is going to get gored too. You look at the middle class as a people that is working in commerce. They're not necessarily doing things, but they're collecting from what other people do.
Martin, let me get one more here. I take your point. Let me get one more. Shirley in Hancock, New Hampshire. Quickly, Shirley, you're on the air and our time
yes.
is short.
Yes. I just want to say that I think that the world has been operating for a long time, especially this country, under a dog-eat-dog kind of mentality and a very Darwinian view of what mankind is. And I think Obama may be ushering in a whole new, I would call it a Shakespearean version of man. I was just reading again, what a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable.
Hamlet.
You know, those words can, all of these issues may take second place to a new idea of what man is capable of, and it's an immaterial quality that we carry at the heart, which defies all reason.
Shirley, you're great. George Pecker, how about it? A new vision of mankind itself here in Obama? These are grand hopes for this president-elect.
I say amen to that. It sounds wonderful. We don't want to put too much on this one man's shoulders, but I think he will mark a great change just in the tone of public discourse in this country. To go back to the earlier points, on science, I think Obama is an empirical thinker. He thinks in terms of evidence. He does speak about religion. He can use that discourse, but I think we'll see a return of empiricism to Washington. Robert Rubin has moved to the left, and so has Lawrence Summers. And as for press conferences, I'd like to see more of them. Obama was not particularly friendly to the press. I think it would be a mistake if he governs the way he campaigned in regard to the press.
We're going to be on a giant learning curve, and you've helped us get a good head of steam to charge down it or up it, George. Thanks for the piece, The New Liberalism in The New Yorker, and thank you very much for being with us this hour.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
George Packer of The New Yorker magazine. Listeners, thanks for your calls. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.